I can start now. So last night's talk was just setting the tone of the retreat, more like inspirational rather than prescriptive. But today is to start the morning talks where you give more detailed information about how to meditate and also to set the tone of the day. To give the big talk in the morning so that through the rest of the day you have something to work with. And if you gave a big talk in the evening, then people will go to sleep, and by the following morning they'll forget it. It's always like the best talks in the morning. So yesterday I was talking about the importance of not striving, the importance of letting go, the importance of being content, the importance of just being in the present moment. And it all comes from a very deep understanding of what we're trying to be doing here. And first of all, I will say this is nothing to do with concentration. Concentration was a word which was used as a translation for the eighth factor of the Noble Eightfold Path, for Samasamadhi. And samadhi is a very important term. It's a Buddhist term for meditation. And it's always been translated as concentration. That was a very unfortunate error, because a much more accurate rendering of that term in the English language is stillness. My teacher Ajahn Chah kept on telling me that, but because I read those books, it took me a long time to realize how correct he was. Even having people coming to learn meditation from me from many different traditions and different backgrounds, people who are fluent in Chinese, who have been studying the Chinese versions of the Buddhist teachings called the Agama, also confirm that in the Chinese rendition it's always to do with stillness, nothing at all to do with concentration. So even in the Chinese version of the Buddha's teachings, it's always to do with stillness. And that changes the whole attitude towards meditation. Concentration is what you do get through striving, through effort. But it always leaves you tense. And it was a surprise for me that when I think I first went to Malaysia, where some of you are from, when I heard someone talk about samadhi headache, meditation headache. And I couldn't understand what they were talking about, because meditation is what you do to get rid of headaches, not to get more of them. So I never heard that term before in where I was meditating. And then you soon realize what was happening. Far too much effort and striving and wanting. And of course that creates tension in your body, in your brain, in your mind. So this is totally counter to what the Buddha was actually teaching. And for those of you who know the story of the Buddha, it's so obvious when you see it that this was what the Buddha was doing before he became enlightened. 6 years of striving and not getting anywhere. And that's where he decided to try another path. And when he gave up striving, his five friends, you can't really call them disciples yet, abandoned him and said, "Oh, this Siddhartha Gautama, he's abandoned the practice, he's given up, he's not striving anymore." And so they just went their own ways and gave up on their friend. They thought he'd just given up the practice. But what happened next was that the Buddha sat under the Bodhi tree. Actually, first of all, he just remembered the time as a young boy when his father was doing a ceremony, and the young boy, being nothing to do, sitting under the shade of a rose apple tree, after which the continent of India was named Jambudipa, the Jambu tree. Sitting under that tree, he just relaxing, not concentrating. If you try and find me, I think it was a 7-year-old kid who can concentrate, it'll be very, very weird. Unless maybe they come from Singapore or China or somewhere and they're forced to concentrate at a young age. But ordinary kids, they relax. And that's what he did. He relaxed and just got into a first jhana because of his previous lives. But he got there through the way of just relaxing, letting things be, letting things happen. And that is the experience he remembered after striving for 6 years. And realized that that was the way to enlightenment. Not the struggle, but the letting go. And even to this day, there's a sutta. It's not the best translation, but I always loved the translation by Venerable Jnanatiloka, who, in his book, The Word of the Buddha, said that this, quoting the Buddha, "This is a path without groaning," he said. So if you're groaning, you've missed the path. If you're, then you're doing something wrong. That is not the path. So, the Buddha let go under the Bodhi tree, and that was the path which he was teaching, stopping craving. And in fact, I emphasize this to many people who understand the history of Buddhism and have read those words of the Buddha. I asked them, what was the first teaching that the Buddha gave? And it was not the Four Noble Truths in the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, which is regarded as the first teaching he really gave. It begins with the middle way. Please avoid these two extremes. One was sensory indulgence of the five senses, not indulging in the pleasure of the mind, inspiration, joy, the happiness of peace, the bliss of freedom. Those are joys of the sixth sense, the mind, which you are supposed to indulge in. The Buddha said that specifically, but the five other senses, to restrain those senses, but also to avoid other practice which weary and tire the body and the mind, the Atta Ginnamatanu Yoga. Ginnamata just means to tire, to exhaust the body and the mind, which is one of the reasons. When I understood that and practiced it and later on had the opportunity to design and build this retreat center, that is why you have comfortable rooms, each with your own ensuite. And people thought at the time, this is indulgence, this is too much. We should have bunk beds, and if you don't sleep, just let it go. But that doesn't work, because that is going to exhaust and tire you. Or sometimes people would complain, Bianca, she's too good a cook. We should not have such delicious food or delicious breakfast. We should just all have the same thing in the morning. Just one big vat of porridge. Take it or leave it. The only choice. But that is not the right practice. You know, some of you can't take that food. Some of you can. So we try and have a choice so you're not exhausting or tiring or getting tummy aches with your body. You have nice beds. Not queen beds or king beds or emperor beds, but just ordinary beds so you can sleep peacefully at night time. Now that is part of the Eightfold Path. And because of my understanding of that path, that's why I was very, very resistant to people who said, let's save costs. Saying, no, it doesn't matter, we're going to have each our own en-suites. It's important to make it comfortable because that is part of the meditation practice. So once you have that middle way, that comfort is a way to stillness. It's settling problems. And you know the word for settling problems is called samatha. If there is any argument in the nuns' monastery, then to settle that argument or that disagreement, We call it in Pali samatha, that's a disturbance. If you have any, say, tummy ache, in order to settle the tummy, to get rid of those feelings, in Pali that is to samatha those feelings, to calm them, to quell them. That is why the bhikkhunis will know in the Sutta Adhikarana samatha dhamma, the last seven rules in the monk's Patimokkha. Any business, to settle that business, we call it samatha. That gives you an idea what this word actually means. To calm the body, to calm the mind, to bring it to a state of tranquility and stillness. So, when we are understanding, it's not about concentrating, which actually is the opposite of samatha, it disturbs everything. Have you ever been to those retreats when people are, I'm trying to concentrate, shut up! You get disturbed. And the other thing which I've noticed, people have told me this, that sometimes they said, I don't want to go on a meditation retreat because I've seen other people go on these retreats. When they came back afterwards, they're so angry. They're a pain in the butt. In fact, they're worse when they come back from a retreat than when they went. And those are retreats where you have to concentrate, where you have to use force, your willpower, which means that when you get home, you're in that habit of using force and willpower to get what you think you need. It doesn't work. So this is all about stillness, not concentration. So in order to get still, concentration, or rather force, does not work. Now I've done this simile so many times before, usually on every retreat. I'm going to go through it very quickly this time, because I'm sure if you haven't seen this by yourself, you've seen this on a video. There's water in my cup. You have to trust me this time. I'm not going to get Ananda to come up and do this. And I say to people, now I'm going to hold my water perfectly still. And then I ask the person, is it still yet? And they say no, and the reason is because I'm paying no attention to it. So I say, and now I'm going to be mindful. I'm being mindful of the water, but it's still moving. Mindfulness is never enough. And then they say, concentrate. Be aware and concentrate. And so, honestly, I actually try this, because I know it doesn't work. I actually concentrate, trying to hold it still. You can do it yourself. You'll find the more you concentrate, the more the water moves. The more effort you put in, the more it shakes. It's an interesting insight and observation. But the answer is very obvious. The only way you can get water in a cup to be perfectly still is, altogether, put it down. Let it go. Now, there's also an important part of this demonstration. When you first put it down, it moves more. Remember that, because when you first let go in meditation, your mind thinks more than usual, or gets more sleepy than usual. That means because all that stuff you've been trying to withhold now comes up, you just got to let it be, and then after a few seconds, that water is perfectly still. Not moving at all. There's no way I could ever hold the water that still. I could never get that water still by force. But by letting go, putting it down, it becomes still all by itself. Because that is the nature of water, when nothing outside of it is interfering. In the same way, repeat this one again, Ajahn Chah Simli, he never used the water one, that was my one. He would put his hand up and wave it up and down. And when he waved it up and down, it's interesting psychology. When I do this, a few people actually get their hand up and wave it as well. I don't know why they do this. But anyway, wave it up and down. And he said, this is leaf on a tree. It only moves because of the wind, which is outside of it. A wind is not intrinsic to the leaf. It only moves because the wind makes it move. If the wind stops, the leaf moves less and less and less until it becomes perfectly still. effortlessly still, because that is the natural state of the leaf. These days we would call it default state. When nothing else is interfering, that's the state it goes to. And so that was Ajahn Chah's simile, and he explained it. The leaf is your mind, which you're trying to get still. And instead of trying to make it still, find out what makes it move. What is the wind in that simile which makes a leaf move? The same as the wind which makes the mind move. And you will find that's always wanting. You want something, even good things, and your mind moves. You don't want anything, and lots of words for that. Contentment is my favorite word. Compassion is almost also wanting. Unconditional mindfulness is also not wanting. All these beautiful words, which you may remember, have important meanings in Buddhism. Unconditional kindness. Kindness doesn't want to change anybody, just lets them be. Respects them for who they are. Opening the door of your heart to this moment, no matter what it is. That is not interfering with it. That's not wanting anything. Present moment awareness, as I said last night, is also not wanting anything. Because to want, you have to go off into time, future or the past. And I often was talking to a theoretical physicist, or just answering one of his blogs through Ajahn Brahmani, the nature of time. Time is created by wanting. If you stop wanting, then time stops and vanishes. Time is what we create. The more we want, the less time we have. Interesting. See how craving, desire, actually constructs what we experience as time. So, when we stop wanting stuff, then your mind moves less and less and less. You just have to be patient and wait for your mind to stop. That is the path. Now, it is important for people to have some idea of where they are in the practice of stillness. Otherwise, people lose a bit of motivation. They think they're getting nowhere, and they think it's not working because they can't see the signs of not progress. That's a bad word. Ingress. Not going on to somewhere else, but going deeper where you already are. And so the signs of ingress, you know, I used to call the stages of meditation. And you can see that in some of the Buddha's teachings, such as the stages of Anapanasati. And every time I teach this, I have to spend a lot of time, please, warning you. These aren't stages you aspire for. These are stages which happen. They're like landmarks. They are little signposts, so you know roughly where you are and how it's working. So when I say these stages of meditation, for goodness, stop trying to strive for these. And don't ever think these stages are personal attainments, as some people do. You catch people talking, how was your meditation retreat? Oh, I got into the delightful breath this time. Oh, that's nothing. I did that the first day. I saw the nimittas, the lights in the mind. I'll explain this later on. Nimittas, I got that years ago. I got the gold nimitta. No, that's not as good as the blue nimitta. No, the white nimitta is the purest and the best. And people go on. And this is what we call spiritual materialism. We take all these experiences in meditation as personal attainments. just like your degrees, your BAs, your MAs, PhDs, and, oh, he's not here, but we all know what PhD means. I've said this so many times that even the professors at Hong Kong University were joking about this. PhD, as Ajahn Brahm says, permanent head damage. That's what it means, PhD. And we've got one of our monks, he's a mama. That's Ajahn Bamali. You can call him Mama Bamali. He's a mama. He's got two MAs. Two MAs makes him mama. So next time you see Ajahn Bamali, hi mama. So I've only got one MA, so I'm Ma Bramali. Ma Brahm. Ma Brahm. Okay. At least I didn't get permanent head damage, thank goodness. So these aren't attainments. They are not something you add to your image of who you think you are. That sense of self is a hindrance. It's what we're trying to let go of. Not we're trying to enhance by how great we are meditating. Or how I came here every morning at 5 o'clock and you other lazy bums, you weren't even here for the chanting. That is nothing to do with this meditation retreat, because I remember catching myself doing that. You know, trying to be the last one in the meditation hall before you went to bed. You know, just out of spiritual pride. So you know what it's like when you do that? I'm going to be the last one. You're sitting here. You open your eyes. Damn it, she's still there. Come on, go out. Oh. And people do crazy things. I caught myself doing crazy things like that as well. Who can sit the longest? And you can have, you know, some of you got your family members here. You have a contest. Okay, let's start sitting. And who gets up first loses. The reason why you're smiling is because you can understand people actually do that. That's nothing to do with what we're up to here. It's not about attaining anything or making these things personal, personal attainments, which is why we don't have them as goals. Each one of these stages are stages of letting go, stages of disappearing. And there was actually Mama Bamali, he coined the term of that book, The Art of Disappearing. And I thought that was actually a brilliant title to, you know, the path of meditation. That's what we're doing here, we're disappearing. The art of disappearing. And not we get a more solid ego. I'm a stream winner, nah, that's nothing. I'm a once returner, nah, nah. I'm an arahat, nah, nah. I'm a bodhisattva, nah, nah. I'm a Buddha, nah, nah. You can't be. But people actually get into that. So, it's nothing to do with attainments. So stop trying to achieve things. That very thing which wants to achieve, will want to get somewhere, which causes you so much frustration and so much disappointment when it doesn't work, that is a hindrance. That is the thing we're trying to transcend. So instead of trying to be someone, instead of trying to get somewhere, just put your cup down and let go. Some years ago, when I was in Sri Lanka, and I think it was that forest monastery to the south, I forget what it's called. No, there was Natuyana to the north, and a nice forest monastery down to the south. I forget what it's called. You probably know. Yeah, whatever it's called anyway. So there was hundreds of monks there that came to listen to my talk. So you have to give a deep talk. And it was recorded on video. And so when one of the monks, you know, his question was, Ajahn Brahm, you teach all these things. Are you enlightened? Do you get jhanas? And we have, there is a, what's called, it's like a loophole, but it's actually one of our rules. It's the eighth pajitya for monks and for nuns, that we're not allowed to tell any lay people anything about our attainments. because they're not attainments. It's not just we're trying to hide things from people. It's just that, no, they're not attainments. They're just disappearing. And so when one of the monks asked me this question, I thought, you've got to give a different answer to stop people misinterpreting the Dhamma and asking you, are you this, are you that? Because then you'll ask yourself, am I this, am I that? So that is when, just on the TV, I said to them, well, if you can tell me who's an arahat, whether it's this fat old English body, my Rupa Kanda, or is it my Vedana Kanda, which is an arahat? Or is it my perception, which is an arahat? Or is it my will? Or is it my consciousness, which is being an arahat? If it is, it vanishes every now and again. It comes and goes. So with that, my attainment comes and goes. So I don't understand what you're talking about. And they said, what about attaining jhanas? And I said, look, and I've mentioned this so many times in these retreats, you know, I'm an expert on jhanas. I write books about them. But I said to everybody, I might as well make this confession right now, at the beginning of the retreat, Ajahn Brahm can't get jhanas. And when I said that, people said, oh my goodness, a fraud, a fake. But this is a point of what I'm trying to say is, Ajahn Brahm cannot get jhanas. I can't get jhanas for my life. I have to vanish first of all. Ajahn Brahm has to disappear. Bye-bye me and all my trying to attain things. When that vanishes, then the jhanas happen. So I cannot claim them as personal attainments. It's not something which I do. It's not an attainment. So I can't be proud of it. I have to vanish. I have to disappear. My sense of self, which is motivates and drives this thing which we call the will, trying to get things, that has to vanish. To let go. Put all of that down. Put it on the ground. And these things happen by themselves. Did the cup make the water still? Or my hand? No, I let it go. So my hand has got no responsibility for that water being still. So same as Ajahn Brahm's got no responsibility for what happens when he lets go. I can't own those attainments. Understanding that is why the Buddha said, don't say that you've got this and you've got that. It's not just against the rules. It's fundamentally, philosophically, it's just a mistake. That's why there was a very funny monk years ago. But he said some very interesting things. Some of you may remember him, a monk called Ananda Mangala. He was Sri Lankan, spent a lot of time in Malaysia, and he had a very interesting upbringing. He told me he was, when he was young, he was the All India ping pong champion. And he actually went to school. He grew up as the best friend of Indira Gandhi, and he decided to become a Trappist Catholic monk. First of all, and they were serious, they'd whip each other, you know, really crazy stuff. And then when he thought, this doesn't make any sense, he said, no, I'm going to leave and I'm going to become a Buddhist. And that, all the very, because he was like well known in India, you know, come from a, you know, grown up with the Prime Minister Indira Gandhi, they said, no, no, you can't do that, you can't do that, you can't do that. And he said, no, I'm going to become a Buddhist. And then they finally said, well, at least become a Muslim. At least believe in God. No, I'm a Buddhist. He's a really great guy. And so, this was, I respect him because he was a bit rebellious. He was not the normal Sri Lankan Buddhist monk, because he was in the Brickfields Vihara in Kuala Lumpur with Dr. Kesri Dhammananda, one of my other great friends. No, he passed away, unfortunately, a few years ago. And Bhante Gunaratna was there as well. And I think, who else was there? I think Venerable Narada could have been there at the time, a long time ago. All these stars of modern Sri Lankan Buddhism were there. And they're just having a cup of tea together, and these couple of fundamentalist Christians came in the room, trying to convert them. And Ananda Mangala, he just looked at them and said, get out of here, you bloody fools. Now, it's not really the words which a monk should say.
they left straight away. And the other one says, oh, thank you, thank you, thank you. You shouldn't say that, but well done. He was a very unconventional Markananda Mangala, but he always used to say when some people asked him, are you enlightened? Are you enlightened? He said, no, but I'm highly eliminated. And I thought, what a wonderful turn of phrase. So, you know, not highly illuminated, not enlightened, but highly eliminated. Now that guy has, you know, got some understanding. So your job here is not to get more things, but to eliminate yourself. Eliminate your sense of self. So in order to do this, we do have the stages of disappearing. A stage when things vanish. So the first stage when things vanish is you're sitting down with your body, and to get into the mind, your body has to vanish, basically, or it's not a problem anymore. You're sitting there, it's comfortable, and it's not disturbing you. That's why we have the middle way, to get your body to be comfortable so it's not a problem, as best you possibly can. So you sit on nice zafus or cushions, or you get your pillows from your room. You can go into other people's room and take all the cushions and just have a big mound of cushions and try to sit on them. If it works, fine, I'll get some more pillows for you somewhere. Just so your body can be comfortable. So you, sometimes no matter how many pillows and cushions you have, it's still not comfortable because you're not meant to sit on the floor, some of you. That's why we have the chairs for you to sit on. Some of you, you can actually sit one meditation in a chair, one on the floor, another one on the chair. Balance it, because if you're sitting on meditation a lot, you do get a bit sore sometimes. Sometimes people say, oh, this room is too noisy, or it's too hot, or it's too cold. That's why each one of you has your own cave, your room. So you can go in your room and sit in there. You can close the shutters, turn off the lights, and it's like a cave in there. So that's a lovely place to meditate. So no noise there. And please also, with those people in the cottages, please regard that as the same as a meditation hall. Please be quiet. Don't bang the doors. And here you have to start talking about burglars. Burglars go in people's houses and they don't make any noise at all. Otherwise they get caught. So if a burglar can go in your cottage, open the door, take something and go out without you hearing it, who is more mindful? Who is higher minded? You or the burglar. So if burglars can do it, you've got no excuse for making noises. So all you need to do is just take a second or two more to open the door quietly. So when you go in and out of your cottage, I want you to develop the burglar meditation mind. I'm a burglar, I'm going in. Because if I make a noise, I will go to jail. So you can close the door quietly. You go into your room and you open it so quietly and close it so quietly that no one hears you. And if you make a cup of tea, you don't go around stirring it up at 1 o'clock in the morning. You can. We were taught this. Even stir tea, do it slowly. If you want some sugar or milk or whatever in it, honey in it, stir it so that hardly anyone can hear it. It can be done if you're careful. So that means that your cottages are like meditation halls. They can be very quiet. There's no reason why you can't do that. And even flushing the toilet. There's an old saying in Australia, because times in the summertime
when there is very, very little water, is you look in the toilet bowl. When it's yellow, let it mellow. When it's brown, flush it down. In other words, you don't have to flush every time. You know, when it's yellow, let it mellow. When it's brown, flush it down. So that means you don't have to make a noise all the time, especially in the middle of the night or when you think other people are meditating. So that means that place can be a comfortable place where you can meditate, so your body can just relax, not too much sound, and that means you can go inside your body. And when you go inside the body, the next thing you're aware of is your mind, your emotional world. And the first thing to do is to go in the center of time. No past, no future. You allow the past and the future to vanish, to disappear. And I said to people recently that how can you let the past and future vanish? It's not a simple thing to do. So the first thing, you have to soften the past and soften the future. Don't blame anybody, don't blame yourself. And give the future, or give the past first of all, some happiness, gratitude. I was saying this last Wednesday night in the talk. Be grateful for all the people you have known. And even if people have mistreated you, lied about you, let you down, thank you so much. Without you, I wouldn't have learned so much. So, what Ajahn Chah used to say is, the mosquitoes become your teacher because you hate them. Because they take advantage of you. Because they know, because you're a Buddhist monk, you cannot squash them. They know that and they exploit it. Many, many times you'd have a mosquito land on you and you can't squash it, so you just, come on, off you go. They know what they would do. They'd just go up and bite you somewhere else. So that didn't work. So instead, out of compassion, they only take a tiny bit of blood. Okay, come on, help yourself. They know what these bloody mosquitoes do. They can actually edit that word out of the talk, please. Well, they do. They put their nose down somewhere. It's only a little bit of irritation. And then mosquitoes, they take their nose up. They didn't like that, so they walk a few steps and try somewhere else. They're just totally exploiting your compassion and kindness. Okay, just once, please. That's enough. It's good enough. Don't be so fussy about it. It's all the blood. It's all the same. But no, they want to have a few exploratory drill holes, first of all, before they choose. I don't know if you've ever done that, but I've done that so many times. It's just really frustrating. Come on, get it over with. So they take advantage of you. So you complain about them. And Ajahn Chah said, no, they are your teachers. Ajahn Mosquito. I learned more from Ajahn Mosquito than I ever learned from Ajahn Chah. So, all the people and experiences in the past which have really irritated you, they are your teachers. Thank you so much for giving me a hard time. I learned so much from my experience with you. So, when you soften the past, when you make it a bit of fun as well, some happiness, then it's so easy to let go of. If you haven't sort of given it some happiness, some softness, some forgiveness, it will keep coming up. You're never free. You never go inside. You're still attached. So, same as the future. The future, give it some happiness. Who knows what might happen? Woohoo! So, you look in the future with some happiness. You know, you may lose your job, you may lose all your money. Woohoo! Now I've got no choice, I have to become a monk. You may get dumped by your partner. Your partner says, I've had enough of you. Hey, now you're free! You may lose your job because of economic downturn. Ah, now I can stay at home all day and do nothing and meditate and become enlightened. You can always look at anything with a positive mind. anything. It's an opportunity. That's what I learned from Ajahn Mosquito. So when you look at the future and the past like that, it's easy to let go of. So you go inside. You've let go of time. This terrible, terrible, terrible prison which people live in. And then you can go into the silence. So that's the next stage of meditation. Not for you to try and aspire towards. It's a stage of disappearing, where you don't need to pass comment and to try and capture things with words. Instead, you prefer the spaces between words, the silence. Wasn't that nice? Just being, not thinking, just knowing. That's the silence. I like doing that trick every time because it always works. People are listening and then they find, hey, it's not that hard to be silent, and it's beautiful. So after a while you'd let go, thought disappears. My goodness, that thought causes all the terrible things in the world. You only have to look at Mr. Trump's tweets on Twitter. Just random thoughts. Crazy thoughts. But they're no different than yours. If all your thoughts would be tweeted like his is, and we could read them all, there'd be some crazy stuff coming out of you. So those thoughts cause all these problems in life. So we can be silent. And that, just experiencing that, be able to let go of all of the past and future and your thinking, and just being. And letting life teach you instead of talking back at life. Have you ever, usually with a partner, you're trying to tell them something and they're always talking at you. Never managed to get a word in edgewise. Talk, 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 talk. That's like your mind talking back at life. Always thinking, saying this, saying that. Never listens to life. It's always thinking about it. So after a while, we learn how to be quiet. Oh, that's so beautiful. In this monastery, there's so many opportunities to be quiet. You just go out for a walk. Feel the sun on your skin. Take your hats off, your socks off. Feel the cold of the texture of the concrete or of the bamboo wood or the carpets. Feel, instead of protecting yourself so much. If it is fortunate enough it rains, go out and get soaking wet. Get all your hair a mess. You don't have to worry about fashion in this retreat. I don't worry about fashion. The nuns don't worry about fashion, so neither do you. You can look a real sloppy mess. That's not breaking your precepts. Your hair can be just all over the place. Yay! Now there's no fashion police to tell me what to do. So you get really wet, soaking, just like when you were a kid. You can find a puddle and jump in it and splash. Actually, should I say this? Okay, because it's a water festival now in Thailand, Songkhla. But don't go out throwing water at each other, please. Already one monk did that to another monk yesterday. Just playing around. So, yeah, it's a water festival, but please don't go around throwing water on me. Now, even monks, they're not exempt from being soaked during the Thai New Year water festival. Years and years and years ago, I never forget this, that just finishing the water festival, the formal part of the ceremony in our temple in Nolamara, and I was a senior monk, and that time Ajahn Yanadama was a second monk. And we were going out together, I was leading the way because I was a senior, and there was a woman waiting around the corner with a bucket of water with my name on it. But you know, I have really good karma. I was stopped by someone. Ajahn Brahm, can I ask you a question about meditation? I said, oh yeah, okay, fine. You go on ahead. And Ajahn Yanadamo, he got soaked with a bucket of water meant for me. He never let me forget that one. If you try that for me, it'll probably get on Venerable Bhadda over there, coming up behind me. So forget that one. So anyway, to feel life instead of thinking about it. So that's letting go, the art of thinking disappearing and just experiencing. And that's when it becomes so easy, once thinking has disappeared, to experience your breathing. Just breathing in, breathing out. The only thing left which is moving. And I've been teaching this for a long time. People have the same experiences which I have. Sometimes I think, am I different? But then I practice and talk to the others and I teach the same. And it's true that if you go looking for your breath, when you first watch the breath, it's quite disturbing. It's not the natural breath. But if you allow it to come to you, just in the present moment, just leave things alone, then when the breath comes to you, it's always really peaceful, natural. And it's a rhythm which I've often thought that one of the most comforting, reassuring rhythms, because it's what you felt when you were in your mother's womb. Imagine, in your mother's womb, what do you feel? Her chest going up and down with her breathing. When you were breastfeeding. You've already forgotten that. It's not in your conscious mind. But it's a rhythm which you can recall subconsciously of reassuring, safe, warm, comfortable. Which is why the natural rhythm of the breath is usually very pleasant. You interfere with it, and of course, then it's not that pleasant. So you're just watching the breathing, just breathing in, breathing out. Ah, nothing else to do in the whole world, just breathing. Ah, so simple for those who don't want to complicate their life. But people love complicating lives. You know, we have a nice shrine there, and people keep putting new things on it. Those little things in the corner with the little plastic on them. Don't know what that's doing there. But if you ever notice that, you put a shrine on and people put things on it. It's already full up, it's full up with emptiness. But they want to put things somewhere. These beautiful free walls, but you put signs on it and put, sooner or later somebody put a photograph on it. Or why do we actually always want to, got a beautiful mountain. And what do people do when they climb to the top on it? Put a flag on it. What are they doing that for? Stupid. But it doesn't stop with a flag. After the flag, then they put a restaurant on top. Can't we leave things alone? So, just watching the breath. Can't be anything more simple than that. Breathing in, breathing out, breathing in, breathing out. But if you think, wow, I'm on the bed, I want the next stage. That's where you go in the wrong direction. You want something more. You're not letting go. You're wanting. So just leave it with the breath. If you've got with the breath coming up, great. That's good enough. What more do you want? Who do you think you are? A bodhisattva about to become enlightened? Forget it. You know, that's one of my skillful means as well. I tell people, you know, usually towards the end of the retreat, I say, look, none of you got jhanas, so you're hopeless. That's impossible. Forget it. You know, you're not up to the scratch to get a jhana. When I tell people like that, and they believe me because they have faith in me, that's my skillful means for them to get jhanas. Because I say, you can't do it. So they give up. They stop trying. And then things happen. So don't try and do things. Just be comfortable with the beautiful, with the breath. When you're comfortable with it, it becomes delightful. Ah, breathing in, breathing out. Don't want to do anything else in the whole world. Oh, this is nice. That only happens when you let go of wanting, craving, aspiring. It just happens naturally. Ah, breathing in, breathing out. Could do this all day. And sometimes you do it many hours. Not because you're trying to beat your record. just because it's fun, it's peaceful, it's gorgeous. And then it gets even more gorgeous. The water becomes more still the longer you leave it alone. And that's when, from the delightful breath, you see the incredible lights. Powerful, blissful, blowing you away. And now, whenever I say that, you can see people actually going more quiet. They stop moving, because they say, yeah, this is what I want. I want those limiters. Be careful. Wanting is going to be the reason you don't get them. So don't want these things. If they come, fine. If they don't come, fine. And that increases the odds in your favor. But if you want them, they will never come. So just you get these beautiful lights in the mind, really blissing out. And I'll tell you more about those later on, because people are always fascinated with limiters. And eventually you go right inside those limiters, and then you get the jhanas. Wow. Those are incredible. They will change your life. And you can get them. Always I'm going to tell the story now. Again, every retreat, say the same old stories. If you want to know why I tell the same old stories, I actually told this at the same old... it's a joke. It qualifies as a joke in a retreat over in... No, actually, Nollamara, a few weeks ago, but quite a long time now. This was told to me in Thailand as I was just coming back on the person driving me from the airport, from the where I was staying, to the airport, to bring me back to Perth. And he'd said the story about Albert Einstein. And Albert Einstein, you know, when he was first became famous... You know, in those days, they heard his name, but not many people had seen him before. And, you know, pictures in newspapers, they're not so prominent. So they knew his name and his reputation in the United States, but they hadn't really seen his photograph. So when he was giving a lecture tour of many, many universities in the U.S., they arranged a driver and a car for him. The same car, the same driver, taking him from venue to venue. And after about 6 or 7 lectures, always the same lecture, the driver driving Albert to another lecture said, "I've heard you say your lecture so many times, I could probably give it myself." And like some of you have heard me speak so many times, you could probably come up here and give the talk. So Albert said, "Wow, yeah, that's a good idea, let's try it." So at the next venue, you know, they swap places just before they arrive at the university, with Albert driving the car and the chauffeur pretending to be the professor. And they welcomed the professor, not knowing it was a trick. And then he went into the lecture theatre, and he gave the lecture with Albert pretending to be the driver sitting in the back. And at the end of the lecture, it actually is amazing, it worked. They all stood up and gave him a standing ovation. What an amazing mind this chauffeur had. But one of the professors was a bit suspicious. So he put his hand up to ask a question. It was a very, very deep and complicated question. And the driver, or rather the driver pretending to be Albert Einstein, the lecturer said to the professor, "That is such a simple question. Even my driver sitting in the back can answer that. Come on, driver, answer it." So you've all heard this so many times. Who's a real Ajahn? You can even answer. But anyway, you get into the beautiful limiters and the beautiful jhanas, and it just happens. And this particular story, on one of these retreats, I don't know which time of the year it was, I was also hanging around the office where people were coming in to register for their retreat. And I remember this guy, a really tall Caucasian Australian guy, coming in. And he was covered with tattoos. And, like, I'm a human being, okay? I stereotype. And said to him and said, "Excuse me, sir, you got the wrong place. The prison is 6 kilometres up the road." I don't know why I said that. And he looked at me and said, "No, I'm registered. This is my name." And he was registered, so he was there. And I thought, oh, crikey, all sorts come on these retreats. But I really got my comeuppance for that, because interview time, that was the guy who came up to me and he said I had a really good meditation, and he started to describe it, and it was a jhana. And that really blew my mind. The person I least expected on a retreat, the person I thought I had no chance at all, was the guy who actually got the jhana. And it was a real obvious jhana. No messing around. Just, and I said, wow, amazing, great. So, if he could get a jhana, then why not you? Perhaps next time before you come on retreat, get some tattoos. And that might help you. I don't know about tattoos. I really got a shock when I was in England last October. Because this was, I taught about a 2 or 3 day retreat in this beautiful place, and this girl came up and said, "I want to show you my tattoo." I said, "Why?" She said, just have a look." It wasn't in a naughty place, it was on her arm. So from her shoulder down to her elbow, she looked at it. I said, "Oh my goodness, that's me." She had a tattoo of Ajahn Brahm on her shoulder. I thought, oh no, what have I done? Life is really weird. I don't know what's going to happen next. Imagine that someone's got a tattoo of you on them. That's a bit scary. But anyway, what it told me, that guy, was that you don't know. Every one of you can. Not every one of you will, but every one of you can. Just follow the instructions. Disappear. Let go. And those are the stages which will happen. They are signposts, landmarks, places where you can know roughly know where you are, what's happening. And if you don't experience those landmarks, it's because you're doing something wrong. You're wanting something. You're doing something. You're trying to get somewhere. So just to sum up those landmarks again, just comfortable body so you can let the body go. Present moment awareness, no past, no future. No thinking. Beyond thinking, into the silence. Being aware of the breath. Breathing in, breathing out. Delightful breath. Oh, so nice. Ah, yes. So you're so comfortable, you feel you can breathe like that for hours. And then afterwards, lights come in the mind. Light stabilizing. Get very, very beautiful. And then into the light, into the jhanas. Stages of meditation. So simple. When you don't try to get there. So that's the talk for this morning. So any questions about what I've been saying, piece of paper out there, and we will deal with them this evening. This morning, there is no interviews, but this afternoon special, there will be some interviews for those who put your name down. And in the meantime, just enjoy. If you are tired the first day, you can take a nap. Don't have to set your alarm, because I'm sure you'll get up for lunch. Or if you need a nap afterwards in the afternoon, or just have a walk, just relax. Slowly ease yourself in to the meditation retreat. Don't go too fast. Sadhu. 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 Okay, very good.